If I tend to wander a little bit or go off track, it's because I didn't get to bed this morning here until 1 o'clock this morning. And so Atlanta time, it would have been 4 o'clock for me. Then I was up at 6, and then Darren Doan came by and did an interview with me for about 45 minutes. So I hope my mental acumen is working well. When this conference was first scheduled, I believe it was in March, with these similar topics, I sat down and started working up some notes for it, and I had about 10 pages of notes. But I'm a tinkerer. I like to kind of add things to it and put a little footnote here and there. So I've got 50 pages here. And I was told I have a little extra time because the Logos guy didn't show up, but I don't think I have that much time. And one of the things about the topic of vision, it goes back a very, very long way, not at all associated with a Christian worldview. When I was raised Roman Catholic in the Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania area. My grandparents are originally from Italy. My last name is really DeMare, D-E, capital M-A-R-E. My grandparents, in order to assimilate, Americanize the name, my grandparents did not speak English very well at all. I did not grow up in an academic setting at all. My parents, I think my mother got her GED. My father served in World War II. He served in, he was actually at Pearl Harbor when it was bombed. He was in the Korean War, had his right leg blown off in the Korean War, had his foot in a Jeep in a mortar attack. So I've lived with a one-legged man until his death. And I learned a lot in that period of time, and I put my efforts into sports. I was athletic, enjoyed it, Western Pennsylvania. I mean, Western Pennsylvania is football town and so forth. And of course, because of that, I played football. But I gravitated to a sport that really isn't very popular, and it's practiced outside the bounds of where the stands are, usually behind the bleachers somewhere. And it's called a shot put. It's an iron ball that you throw. Golf, at least you hit a ball, you can go around and you should get paid for it. You're not gonna get paid for throwing an iron ball around at all. But it was something that I gravitated towards. And I picked up a magazine in 1964, Strength and Health magazine, and there was an article in there by a man named Dallas Long. And he was the existing world record holder in the 1960s. And he was also, he held the high school record in the shot put for 69 feet, 3 inches. And I decided I had a vision, not the perceptual type vision, but I had the vision, I had the goal that I wanted to break that record and be the first high school shot putter to throw 70 feet. And that's not a very auspicious thing to want to do. But that's not the point of this story. The point of the story is the very nature of visions, of their future orientation, what it takes in order to accomplish a vision, to set it out, to lay it out, what's necessary to make it work, what are the tools that are there, who do you need to help you with it. And so at 14 years old, that's what I decided I wanted to do. I had that particular vision, and it was interesting in this particular article. It said it showed what Dallas Long threw as a sophomore. It showed what he did as a junior, and eventually the 69 feet 3 inch throw as a senior. I had no coaching. There was no internet. You couldn't go on there and look at YouTube to find out how to learn how to throw this. Our coaches knew nothing about the event, and I had because of a couple of kind of body. Things I didn't like about myself, a hole in my chest, my scapula stuck out in the back, kind of awkward looking, I decided I was going to lift weights, and I did pretty well with it. And the two went together. And I actually played football my sophomore year. My first time my father met my wife-to-be back in 1977, the first thing he said to her was, you know, Gary could have played professional football. I'm thinking, that was my father's vision for me. And when I quit playing football when I was my sophomore year, he was devastated by that. But I had a particular vision, and I pursued that vision with a vengeance. I lifted weights 6 days a week. I had to gain weight. One Thanksgiving, I woke up, I weighed 178 pounds. By the time I went to bed that night, I weighed 190. That's what you had to do. You had to put on muscle mass. And by the time I was a high school senior, I weighed 215 pounds. I could bench press 385 pounds. I could do an overhead press with 315 pounds. And my sophomore year, I threw as far as Dallas Long did. In my junior year, I threw actually a little bit farther than Dallas Long did. But my senior year, I didn't make it. I threw 64 feet, 2.5 inches. I was ranked fifth in the nation that year. But that vision idea really stuck with me. And the next phase of that was I took what I knew and I passed it on to a fellow who lived up the street from me. His name was Ron Semkew. He was from the Ukraine. His father was mean to him, dragged him around by his hair, made Ron tough. He was the strongest, probably his senior year in high school, probably the strongest teenager in the United States. Could bench press 435 pounds as a senior, 17 years old. He won the state, Pennsylvania state, broke my record in the Pennsylvania state record holder. He won that event as a sophomore, a junior, as a senior. He threw over 70 feet in high school. He was the first high school student and college student to throw both the 12-pound shot and the 16-pound shot over 70 feet. It was that vision thing that impacted me more than anything else in my life. When I became a Christian, I just thought I would be able to encapsulate that vision thing because everybody else would have had that vision thing as well. And I would redirect it in building the kingdom of God. But I just noticed a lot of people didn't have the vision thing. Very kind of like some of the coaches that I had growing up. Here you had two guys, as strong as we were, as fast as we were, and athletic as we were. I was a Pennsylvania state record holder. Ron was a national champion, knew what he could do, and not one of those coaches ever came to us and asked, how did you get the way you are? What are you doing? They never did. And I found when I became a Christian that Christians didn't have a big enough vision thing. They didn't really see that the gospel applied to every area of life and it needed to be transformed from the bottom up. And I was really I was disappointed. And I'm very thankful for the gifts that God has given me and the things that I have done. But on Wednesday, I got a phone call. And I'm not going to go into what the discussion was on this phone call, but that phone call disturbed me in such a way that I made a complete reassessment of where I had been with the vision thing and providential to this particular conference. Because you're operating within the context of someone who had a vision and put it into practice. I mean, that is something that unfortunately a lot of Christians out there have no conception of. So in order to understand how to develop this vision, you've got to have the basic principles that I believe our founders had in the development of what makes a Christian vision work and for the transformation of the world in which we live. And it is, in fact, much of it is informational. You know, Doug had mentioned that you go back and you read the works of these other men, and their knowledge of the Bible was just unbelievable. And today we have people have scattered verses here and there, and they'll mix what the Bible has to say about things with you know, with what the Bible says, you know, God helps those who help themselves. I mean, it's we really are an ignorant people when we come to what the Bible has to say about things. And at my talk tomorrow, I'm going to be dealing a little bit about internalizing the Bible. And you can't internalize what you don't know, what you don't have within you and yourself. So this vision thing is extremely important to me because I turned 70 years old this year. And I've been at this for 45 years. And people ask me, you know, when did we meet? And it's always like 10 years ago. And in some cases, it's 20. So it's either 10 or 20 years ago. And I'll see that there's a movie out. And see, that movie came out in 1985, 35 years ago. When I was born, 70 years was 1880. So I'm near, you know, I don't know how many more years I have. But if there's one thing I really want to get across to Christians is they have to have a vision that is in many ways incomprehensible. And it's oftentimes it's the big visions that take the necessity of little visions in order to develop. And then there has to be a community of visionaries in order to make it work. And that's why you're here. In fact, the very first talk I gave at one of your events, I don't even remember this, up in Memphis, Tennessee. I'm kind of embarrassed by it a little bit because I'd send my outline in, I think, 3 or 4 months ahead of time, which I never do. I would still work on this stuff on the plane coming over here. Sometimes I don't know what I'm going to talk about until I get up here and actually, you know, talk. And I woke up that morning and I read over what I had sent 3 or 4 months ago. And I said, I really don't want to do this. I mean, they've got the outline. It was part of their deal. I mean, why get up there and talk about what I just did? So I got up that morning and I took a few notes and I called it the Peking duck syndrome. And if you've ever had Peking duck, when we were in China, I'd always heard about it. And the duck literally melts in your mouth. It's so good. But in order to get that duck to taste that good, what you have to do is bind its feathers and its feet and just kind of feed it until it gets soft. And then you cook it slowly. And I think that's one of the reasons why we don't have a lot of vision today among Christians is because they take in this information and they what do they do with it afterwards? And their minds and hearts and their abilities atrophy to such an extent that when a crisis comes like we're having today, and when things need to be done, people don't know what to do. It's because we haven't had our senses trained to discern good and evil. And I think that also applies to the vision thing as well. We don't know what to do in terms of a vision. Now, I'm not talking visionary type things. I'm talking about, you know, goals and ambitions in the development of ourselves personally and our families and business and art and so forth and so on. I mean, 25 years ago, people could not have conceptualized where we are today. And if you go back and we talk about the founders, if you go all the way, you go back 100, 200, 300, 400, 500 years, there is no possible way that they could have envisioned what's taking place today. The camera that I'm looking at right now, phone in my pocket, recording it, putting it up on an internet, those are such big visionary things that there was no conception that anyone would have had those visionary things. They didn't have the tools. They didn't have the information. They didn't have the categories in order to be able to do that. But there were some things they had that gave them ability to understand the world in which they lived, and they applied those in their small visionary pursuits. They put those things to work that got us to where we are today. I mean, you look at a lot of this technology that's going around today and the science and so forth, it's amazing how many Christians laid the groundwork for all this in mathematics and sciences and chemistry and so forth, because they understood the basic elements necessary in order to develop a visionary way of looking at the Christian life. And so I've put together what those basic foundational principles are in all of this. And I've come up with essentially four of them. One is the Bible's vision, pushing or forcing the antithesis. The world counts and time counts. And I'm going to kind of introduce this with a book, two books, and a review that I read of this particular book. And I'm always thankful when I read an author who had a completely different conception of historical events in his field of study, who then turned around and after additional investigation completely changed his mind. And the book is, it's called Dominion, How the Christian Revolution Remade the World by Tom Holland. And it's not an easy book to get through. And there's another book out there, much popular, by Vishal Mangalwadi, the book that made your world, is very, very good, especially if you have teenagers. It's a great book to read, a lot of great storytelling in it. And it does the similar thing, but in a very popular way. But Dominion, How the Christian Revolution Made the World. And there was a review by Marvin Olasky, a self-professed former communist and now editor of World Magazine. And here's what Olasky wrote. Until this year, this was written in 2019, the first 20 pages of Witness by Whitaker Chambers, which was a book published in 1952, comprised the most brilliant preface or foreword I had ever read. Chambers had crossed over from communism to Christianity. He was a party member and a Soviet spy. He explained that communism is man's second oldest faith. Its promise was whispered in the first days of the creation under the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you shall be as gods. And gods play to win, as Chambers goes on to show in the next 788 pages of his book, Witness. Now, Witness was written to his children. Now, why did Chambers become a communist? He referenced his brother's suicide at 22 as one reason. And suicide is almost always associated with hopelessness. Communism offered me what nothing else in the dying world had power to offer at the same intensity, faith and a vision, something for which to live and something for which to die for. But of course, what Whitaker Chambers found out, communism did not live up to its vision. It became the enemy because of its false vision. For Chambers, the enemy wasn't only communism, it was those who believed in the primacy of secular man. Now, it's Olasky's next paragraph that he makes a comparison between the first 20 pages of Tom Holland's book, Dominion, and Whitaker Chambers' 17 pages in the preface to his book, Witness. And it's Olasky's view that Dominion knocks the start of Witness out of first place as the best preface or foreword or introduction in any book. Those pages beautifully tell the amazing story of how a culture that had esteemed only big winners began to care about, in worldly terms, big losers. If the familiar gospels no longer move you to wonder and perhaps tears, read that preface. Now, this is obviously high praise, especially for someone, you know, coming and changing his view about the history of Christianity and so forth. But the comparison goes deeper because it expresses a fundamental contrast that is missing from the accolades given to Chambers's memoir, Witness. So you see, it's not enough to change sides But to make a fundamental change in thinking, that's the first step, and then to act upon it. The ultimate goal is not just the conversion. And Dr. Gary North wrote the following to me in an email about Chambers' introduction. I want you to listen to this. Because in essence, faith without works is dead. Having a vision is important, and that's a fundamental step. But not working that vision is a problem. It's not the Christian worldview. And here's what Gary North wrote to me in that email. Whitaker Chambers' introduction was powerful. It was one of the most wrong-headed pieces of literature ever written. You know, if you know Gary North, you understand Gary North at this point. He said he felt that he was joining the losing side when he became a Christian. He was a pietist. I hope I'm not going to offend anybody by the next one. Amillennial and a retreatist of the First Order who was consistent with what he said he believed about joining the losing side. He retreated to a farm and stopped writing. And this is my words next. Instead of moving to a small town in Idaho with the ironic name Moscow to start a school, publishing company, K-12 school, a national school movement, and a college, and a perpetual thorn in the side of a lot of people. You see, conversion isn't enough. Vision isn't enough. If you don't work the vision that you have, you really don't have a real vision. And I wonder how many of you, and I'm putting myself in this category as well, thought about doing something 20 or 30 years ago and never did it for whatever reason. And how much has been lost to the Christian community and the Christian world because we didn't act on visions. And sometimes you think those visions are they're just too outlandish. And the plane coming over here, I turned on this show. I think the name of it was called General Magic. And General Magic is about a group of people who were siphoned off from Apple to create stuff that had never been created before. And there was no conception that these things could even exist. I have an interest in science fiction, and one of my authors was Wilson Tucker, and I have autographed copies of all of his first editions and first printings of all of his works. And he, when the year 2000, you know, turned over, he said, "If you read all science fiction, you will never find one reference at all to email." But these very extremely talented people siphoned off from Apple to create things that had never been created before and didn't even have any idea that they could be created. And there was one of the particular men there had a book. It was called The Red Book. And he had every vision in his mind as to what could happen. And if you want to know where your cell phone came from, it was from that group of people. And he opens it up and there's a picture of it. There's a design of the cell phone way back when there was no way to use that cell phone. It was like Thomas Edison. Thomas Edison invents the light bulb. Where do you plug the thing in? Nothing existed. Think of that. They were still, you know, lighting homes with gas. Of course, that ended up becoming a threat to the gas industry. So Thomas Edison, not only after inventing the light bulb, had to invent the entire power grid. And he did it. He actually did it. Put the whole thing together and did a square block of a city, put it all together. Then you had to convince people to buy this stuff. I mean, that's vision. I mean, you invent something and you say, I don't have a buyer for it. Even when the cell phone was invented and actually when they were putting it all together, who do you sell it to? You can't use the thing. Now, this idea of a vision they immediately began to find out what they needed is cooperation with other people. And that cooperation meant AT&T, it meant Sony, Motorola. It's a fascinating story. And I didn't get to watch the whole thing. I probably watched it on the way back because I was still working on my notes. But that's the kind of conceptual vision that we as Christians have got to understand. And I remember when I was in high school, when people would say, Gary, you'll never do it. You'll never be able to do it. Well, it was true. I didn't do it. But I did what they didn't do. That is, become a state record holder and end up being ranked fifth in the nation and getting a college scholarship and so a sports scholarship and so forth. And what I learned from that, I'm here today, written 35 books. Talk about a vision. There was no way in the world that I would have ever thought about writing 35 books. You know what my transcript in high school says? Gary's not college material. And the thing of it is, they were right. I wasn't. But I transferred that visionary ability into deciding I was going to be a college graduate. And then when I became a Christian in 1973, it transformed me in ways that I never imagined. So let's just look at a couple of things in terms of the Bible's idea of vision. Now, remember, this is written in a time where conceptually none of these things were in anyone's purview. And so when you read these and understand these passages, I want you to understand something here. I believe God plants seeds in scriptures that if we truly believe them and apply them in every area of life, we'll have no idea what those seeds will bring forth. God wasn't going to spoon feed us all this stuff. He put us here in order to work the plan, to work the vision. Even in a sin-drenched, corrupt world, this is what we were called to do. For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. All the ends of the earth will remember and turn to the Lord, and all the families of the nations will worship before you, for the kingdom is the Lord's, and he rules over the nations. And the Lord will be king over all the earth, and in that day the Lord will be the only one, and his name the only one. The meek shall inherit the earth. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. And Jesus said, all authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. Go, therefore, and make disciples of all the nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all that I commanded you, and lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. Now, all those passages that I cited, you all know. But I believe we have confined those passages to a supra-spiritual realm alone. Battling back and forth with this fellow on Facebook who's asking me questions about things. I'd written an article about the fallacy of the earth is not your home. And I got some real criticism from people. Are you saying that the earth is our home? I said, yeah, of course it is. Where do you go at night? You go to your home. The earth is your home. I said, we have multiple citizenship. We have dual citizenship. My two sons and I have we have Italian citizenship as well. I got two citizenships. This is our home. God created this world to do stuff with. And yet, if you talked with a lot of people, they don't have any regard. They're in a temporary situation down here. There's like staying at the motel. You leave the towels on the floor, you put them down here, you don't care about making the bed and all that kind of stuff because it's not your room. This is our home right now. And God put us here for this worldly purposes, for this worldly goals, for this worldly visions to be worked. Those passages, we need to get them out of the confines of my, you know, Jesus in me and nothing else matters. So that's the first step. The Bible gives us the basis for determining a vision, because God has given us the world, and he has given us the world to work with that world, even though the creation was defiled because of sin. In 1 Timothy chapter 4, 1 through 4, God's creation is still good. This is a good creation. You see these floors? These were trees at one time. Look what we've been able to do with God's creation. You look around you. Everything that you see here is manufactured from things that don't exist in the real world. I mean, that's an amazing thing. There's nothing, no animal does anything like this. This is what we do with God's creation. Now, people who don't believe in God also put this stuff together because they can't live any other way. They have to live in God's world. That's something we'll talk about. So understand, a biblical vision is simply taking what God has given us and the mind to create those things and to use it for his honor and his glory in every facet of life. To bring honor to him is to take what he has given us and to manipulate it in a way that brings honor and glory to him. And there used to be a day when that was indeed the case. You can think of hospitals. Hospitals were given, you know, names, and you know, St. Paul, St. Jude, whatever the case might be. They gave that in honor for the God that created them and gave them the ability to do those things. The educational establishments that we have as well. So that's the first thing. The Bible encapsulates for us the basis upon which a visionary aspect of the gospel can take place. Vision requires never forgetting the antithesis. It's never about winning, Cornelius Van Til told Greg Bonson. It is about exposing their inconsistency. God does everything else. Never forget the antithesis. This was said to Greg Bonson in summer of 1985. What is the antithesis? And what does it mean to force or push the antithesis? Our founders understood there were certain fundamental assumptions about reality that make the world work the way it does. If you don't follow those operating assumptions and you try to live inconsistent with those operating assumptions, you will not last in this world. And there are probably 1,000 or more examples that's the case. I mean, in our own culture today, in terms of economics, you don't follow oikonomics, the lawful ordering of a household. That's what the word oikonomics is all about. Oikos, house, nomos, law. The oikonomics of the household, and the household not just being where you live, but God's house. You don't follow those rules, you're going to end up in bankruptcy. I remember the first talk I heard Dr. Gary North give when I was in seminary. He was there with Richard Mao, and he and Richard Mao it wasn't a debate so much as it was each one of them giving their views on various things. And Dr. North gave an exposition of Isaiah chapter 1. Your silver has become dross, and your water and your wine diluted with water. And it was amazing to me when I was a Reformed Theological Seminary how everyone talked about developing and implementing a Christian worldview, but yet nobody was doing it. And Dr. North came in and gave that passage and said, look, this is applicational in terms of economics. Yeah, our coinage just doesn't have dross in it. Our coinage is dross. It's all dross. You ever notice, the dime, quarters, half dollars, and silver dollars, and gold, and so forth, they have these little striations along the edge, and pennies and nickels don't have those. Pennies and nickels are smooth. Why is that? It's because people would clip coins. Gold is very soft. They take their knife and clip a little bit off of it, take it to the assayer's office, get a little extra money out of the whole deal. That's what inflation is. And inflation is the increase in the money supply. Well, what happens when that happens? Well, your dollars, your money is then devalued because it's worth less and less. And that's what our government did. Finally got rid of silver coins. We don't do gold anymore. In fact, gold was confiscated. You talk about masks. You talk about masks. There was a time in the United States where they told you had to turn all your gold in. I mean, it was against the law to keep gold. Well, obviously not everybody turned their gold in because there are still gold coins from that particular era. So what does it do to an economy? It dilutes the value of your money. And that's what governments do. So here's a fundamental principle found in Scripture, and you push the antithesis with this. That has forced people to live consistently with that idea to see what happens to them. It helps them change their minds about those types of things. So those little striations on those coins, they're still on there, but those coins they're not worth any more than a penny or a nickel anyway, were to keep people from clipping the coins. If you ended up with a smooth-edged coin, you know someone had clipped it, and it wasn't worth its particular value. And then you had to go back to the assayer's office to give you the true value of it. So defending the Christian worldview against unbelieving thought takes an understanding that every worldview has a centralized guiding principle that serves as a foundational operational assumption about the nature of reality. This means if you're going to develop a vision for what God has called you to do, and I don't know what that might be, or cooperate with someone else, small or large, you have to begin at the beginning, where the Bible begins. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. God is not a probability argument that we reason to, making us the foundational principle and ultimate authority. God is the operating presupposition, the touchstone proposition that we reason from. You can't get to where you need to be if you don't begin by reasoning from God to it. And our founders understood this. It's on every page of their writings. And here's what we're competing against. Here's where we have to kind of force the antithesis. Atheism. If atheism is right, can anything ultimately be wrong without borrowing moral capital from the Christian worldview? It's not about being rational or moral. It's about accounting for rationality, logic, and morality. Science writer Ben Bova is an atheist who wrote an op-ed in 2012 that appeared in the Naples Daily News with the title, "Ben Bova, History Says Atheists Just as Moral as Unbelievers," where he argued that atheists can be just as moral as religious believers. Why is anything moral or immoral? Who says? How do we know? If there is no God, who says any life matters? The evolutionary process knows nothing of morality. Humans evolved by raping, killing, and eating their neighbors. And so if we're going to develop a long-term vision for the world in which we live, we have to force the antithesis. We can't go in there compromising or saying we can live with two ways of looking at the world. It just doesn't work that way. I'm going to go through these quickly. It says rationalism, reason rules without ever determining why reason is or should be reasonable. We are living in a world that claims to be rational, that almost everything that's being done these days is irrational. How many genders are there? I don't know. I think the last count was at 58, 70-some genders. This is coming from rational people. Governor Tom Wolf, a Democrat of Pennsylvania, accused Jenna Ellis, a senior legal advisor for President Donald Trump's re-election campaign, of hate speech. And what was the hate speech? Because she called a man who claimed he was a woman a guy. Who is being rational and who is being irrational here? Well, those who claim that rationalism rules are the ones who are being irrational. A black woman just apologized for playing a black woman in a film because she did not consider herself black enough. You can't make this stuff up. Our job is made much easier today by all the information that's out there. It makes, you know, writing an article every day is easy today. Oh, look at this. You know, this 20, I can write 20 pages on that. The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources has taken face mask requirements to a new level, mandating that employees wear the mask even if they're at home on virtual meetings. One of my wife's favorite verses in the last couple of weeks, she's been going through Ecclesiastes. This particular verse, Ecclesiastes 9:3. The hearts of the sons of men are full of evil and insanity in their hearts throughout their lives. Afterwards, they go to the dead. I mean, this is where we are today. Now, this is, in one essence, what I've given you so far, and a couple of more here, this is good news for us. Because, you know, if you build it, they will come. If they destroy it, they will run away. If we don't have this built-up culture alternative, a true counterculture, which is, in fact, the true culture, to attract the unbelieving thought, then there's the hopelessness begins to set in. I don't know if you saw this latest statistic that I don't know if this is real or not, that 25% of teenagers contemplated suicide because of the COVID-19 virus. And I'm thinking, where are these, you know, you think about what's transpired in the 20th century with Great Depression. People did, in fact, kill themselves during the Great Depression. The Dust Bowl went on for years. Wars. I mean, it's just remarkable, and what it toughened people up. We don't have that today. But the point is here: the rationalists have become irrational. Mysticism, unknown forces rule. Why are we obligated to obey a force? How does one derive meaning from an inanimate force? Where's the legitimacy of it? Hedonism, pleasure rules. Who gets to define what's legitimately pleasurable if moral relativism is the reigning moral theory? Relativism, we get to make up our own rules. You get to make up your rules and I get to make up mine. I can do anything I want as long as it doesn't hurt anyone. Who says? Who says that's a rule? Who ultimately says, I can't hurt you? Where is that codified anywhere in an atheistic, rationalistic, mystic worldview? Now, I'm telling you, again, unbelievers can't live consistently with their operating assumptions. They have to live and borrow from our worldview. They're interlopers. They take from us, claim it to be their own, but they will become more and more consistent with it. And I'll talk more about that tomorrow. Postmodernism, there are no rules. As atheists become more consistent with their worldview, they become more consistent with the absurdity of their operating assumptions. Again, you can't make this up. A math professor who teaches at Brooklyn College tweeted that math is not in any way objective, and any such idea reeks of white supremacist patriarchy. Now see, to force the antithesis, let's say this woman is getting, I don't know, $8,000 a month, pay her $800. If math is not in any way objective, here you go. Here's your check. Pragmatism mixed with moral relativism and evolutionary ethics. It's a rule only if it works. But who determines when something has worked? Marx, Lenin, Pol Pot, Adolf Hitler? They were all pragmatists. Killing Jews was both ideologically and pragmatically moral, given Hitler's worldview. At the Nuremberg trials, I don't know if you followed anything about the Nuremberg trials, 1945, 1946, putting these Nazi leaders on trial. And they just sat back with smug looks on their face because the defense made the point, you can't impose your alien worldview on us. This is the realm of living within the context of what worked for Germany. And the problem was at Nuremberg is that the prosecutors, the judges involved, were in a dilemma. This is 1945, 1946. Darwin had come along 1859. Scope's trial 1925 comes along, essentially codified Darwinism. It was codified in the 1927 with the Buck versus Bell case, where the state had legitimacy to sterilize people in the interest of the state. That particular decision of that court case, Oliver Wendell Holmes resided in, and Oliver Wendell Holmes was actually quoted at the Nuremberg trials. And so faced with this argument, Robert H. Jackson, chief counsel for the United States at the trials, was compelled to appeal in ad hoc fashion, yet it's just bringing in the Christian worldview capital for the moment. He appealed to permanent values, to moral standards transcending the lifestyles of particular societies, in a word, to a law beyond the law. Borrowed moral capital from the biblical worldview of individual nations, whether victor or vanquished. See, this is the dilemma. I don't know if you've ever heard of the story of Marwan Mues. He was a German man who ran an advertisement in the newspaper that he wanted to find somebody who would be interested in being killed, cooked, and eaten. And he actually got people to agree. In fact, one particular man did in fact agree, and Marwan Mues actually plied him with alcohol and started cutting body parts off, and they were eating them. The problem was there was no law against this in Germany. What did he do wrong? This fellow agreed to be killed, cooked, and eaten. And so what's wrong with that? Well, in a world of pragmatism, relativism, and atheism, there is nothing morally wrong with that. And unfortunately, what we have today in politics essentially is a pragmatism without any moral base. The only way to change that is for Christians to develop a better vision of civil government and its application to every area of life, and getting back to the standards of how that would work. Materialism, only matter matters. We are bags of meat and bones and blood animated by electricity. That's what you are. All we are is dust in the wind, nothing beyond the grave. This is from Richard Dawkins. In the universe of blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt, other people are going to get lucky, and you won't find any rhyme or reason to it, nor any justice. The universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, and no good. Nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. DNA neither knows nor cares. DNA just is, and we dance to its music. Now, I guarantee you, you force this on a society by people who take this seriously and consistently, and people are going to start looking for answers, and will we be there in order to supply that particular answer? And by the way, if the Columbine shooters, they didn't quote this in particular, but they understood the essential principle, and this also the shooter, I think, in Finland, said that he was operating on a term of Darwinian evolution. Monism asserts that only one ultimate substance or principle exists in the universe. All was one, so there was nothing to argue about. There can't be an antithesis, which in itself is an admission that there is an antithesis. Much of today's leftist thinking is monistic. There are no contrary opinions to debate. Homosexuality is settled science. Thus, people who leave the homosexual lifestyle do not exist. People who want to exit homosexuality are denied organizations that help them transition out of homosexuality. Barclays has closed the bank account of a United Kingdom Christian charity. The core issue is trust. it offers individuals voluntarily seeking to leave homosexual behaviors and feelings. See, transitioning is a one-way street. It's monistic. You can transition from being a man into a woman. You can transition from being a heterosexual to homosexual, but you cannot go back. Once the argument is made, that is the end of everything. And if specific worldview systems like that aren't enough, there are a whole bunch of other ones as well. A brilliant college professor, the writings of a Zen master, the directives of a cult leader, the latest scientific studies. By the way, Forbes article in Forbes magazine said that we should not dispute with research, do our own research. He says in a recent article, scientist Ethan Siegel suggests people should not do their own research on topics as they are not qualified to understand, and doing that research yourself could be dangerous. There are statistical analysis, opinion polls, the Constitution of the United States, psychics, fortune tellers, frequently quoted philosophers, newspaper and magazine editors, judges, television news anchors, Oprah, Dr. Fauci, the high-minded opinions of Hollywood actors, and even alien life forms. People are gotten so relativistic, and they have also gotten irrational, and they're looking for something out in space, some sort of mystical aliens coming down here who are going to save us. For those who are interested in that particular topic, I suggest you watch the Twilight Zone, the old Twilight Zone, To Serve Man. If you haven't seen it, it's worth watching. When the ever-changing worldviews of a splintered secularism fail to lift up to their claims of ultimacy, the university is quick to shut out competitive debate. And this is where we are right now, and you've experienced this personally, and where we are in our culture. So this is a fight. A visionary thing isn't always offensive, it's also defensive. There are things that we are going to have to fight for if we believe in the vision that we have. And I can see here, I'm running out of time. My 50 pages is coming to an end. One of the things that I found in doing this work on this is that visions require taking God's creation seriously. I had mentioned that earlier. Let me just run down a couple of things. I had mentioned Wilson Tucker's email comment about, you know, there are things that just scientists and fiction writers just could not contemplate. But give me some real things here. What was the most revolutionary change that was made in invention in the kind of the probably 600, 700, 800 years ago? What was the one thing that changed almost everything but that particular period of time? It was Gutenberg's printing press. In fact, it's on the list. What was the first thing that Gutenberg printed? But Latin version of the Bible. He had, like Edison, he had to develop a technology that didn't exist. And it transformed things because it put the Bible in the hands of the populace. In the 19th century, if you wanted to travel, you basically went three ways. You walked, you took maybe a donkey or a horse. Or finally, we had the train probably took you, you know, 60 miles per hour, but you could only go in certain directions. Until Samuel F.B. Morse came along and developed the telegraph and Morse code. Now, Morse was a Christian. One of the first things that came across was called What Hath Thou Wrought? What Hath Thou Brought into Being? Is a quotation from the Bible. Now, why did he invent it? He was a painter. He was doing a portrait of Lafayette, and he had gotten word that his wife was sick. But by the time Morris got that message and finally made it to his wife, she was already dead and buried. And so he worked to develop a system that you could communicate quickly. And so we went from walking a couple miles per hour to horses a few more miles per hour to a train going maybe 60 miles per hour, but only in certain areas where a train would go, to 186,000 miles per second with electricity going. Another Christian. The Wright brothers studied the wings of birds to develop their self-powered airplane. This was in 1903. We put a man on the moon 66 years later. There were people alive in 1969 who were able to see both events. It's amazing. Again, they were Christians. In fact, they would not fly their planes on Sunday. These were visionary people who saw the need for something and began to see how it serviced other people, and it made a drastic change in our society. I could go on with this if anyone is. Send them this outline if you just email me at gdamar@gmail.com, and I'll send you a copy of this. The last thing I want to point out here is that vision requires a future and action. As many of you may know, I write on the area of eschatology, and I've always said that eschatology matters. What a person believes about the future determines how he will live in the present and plan and work in the future. And we have today, we've been stymied by this idea that we are living in the last days. Jesus is coming back soon. The rapture is right around the corner. You can't change anything that's going on today. Why rearrange the deck chairs on the Titanic? You've heard these things over and over and over again. When you have a shortened view of the future, you give the chance to other people to co-opt the future while we sit back and do anything. When Hal Lindsey came out with his book, The Late Great Planet Earth, in 1970, that was 50, think of that, 50 years ago. He made the prediction that everything was going to come to an end before 1988 because Israel had become a nation again in 1948. Jesus said this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Generation was 40 years. 1948 plus 40 is 1988. We're doing this now. This is 2020. Obviously, he was wrong. But it still stymies a lot of Christians today because they fundamentally believe we're living in the last days and there's no hope to change anything. And I know this, again, is may seem unbelievable, but I got an email from someone who said that we should all vote for Joe Biden because it will speed up the return of Jesus. It may speed it up, but probably not in the ways that you expect. And there was another one. It was an article in a book by Tom Sine. He was flabbergasted by this particular comment. Where this woman said that, why are we bothering to help the poor and do all those sorts of things? Because it will postpone the return of Jesus in the rapture. Now, look, I know not everyone believes that, or people who believe that particular end time view are still actively involved in things. Tim LaHaye was a good example of that, and his wife, Concerned Women of America, as well. He was inconsistent with it. And I remember I had a conversation with Norm Geisler. This was a number of years ago, and we were talking, and he was telling me about all these optimistic things that were happening around the world. And I said, Norm, you're starting to sound like a postmillennialist. I noticed you talk about these sorts of things and it changes their disposition. The way they think about things changes. You keep telling someone there's no hope in the future, there's no hope in the future, like Whitaker Chambers' brother, you know, said it's hopeless. If there's no hope in the future, why am I bothering with the things in the present? And while you might not kill yourself, you suicide yourself in limiting what you can do in the future. The Bible is always future-oriented. It pushes us in the future. Failure is future-oriented as well. Something a lot of people don't think about. When you fail, you've got one of two ways of going with failure. You can let the failure defeat you, or you can say, I'm gonna beat this failure. I'm gonna work harder the next time. I'm gonna figure out what I did wrong. And there's one thing about Thomas Edison, he failed more than he succeeded in most of his inventions. Well, I've run out of time here. But I want to leave you with the idea that vision is important. Small as it may be, large as it may be, having a vision about what God has called you to do is something that is in all of us. And I want to say one other thing to you. You don't, in many cases, you don't know how talented you may be. If someone had told me when I was 18 or 19 years old, Gary, one day, I don't know if I've ever said this before, but at one time I dated a witch. she was always making prophecies about me. She said I would be dead by the time I was 30. If she had said to me, Gary, you know, one of these days you're going to write 35 books and you're going to be in Moscow, Idaho, and you're going to be speaking to a bunch of men on how to change the world. I said, yeah, right. I would have gotten rid of her a lot sooner. So this is serious business, and you're in a place with other people here who share a lot of what you are all about and what needs to be done. And we have here a microcosm of what's possible in all of our lives. And as your children grow up, don't dampen their vision as crazy as it might be. Thank you very much.